I'm Carrie Fountain, and this is Just to Say, where we talk to poets about the poems they create and the poems that created them.
And I think the great secret of this love poem is that it is an elegy of the love was over when I wrote this poem. Love Poem Without a Drop of Hyperbole by Tracy Brimhall. I love you like ladybugs love windowsills. Love you like sperm whales love squid. There's no depth I wouldn't follow you through. I love you like the pawns in chess love aristocratic horses. I'll throw myself in front of a bishop or a queen for you, even a sentient castle. My love is crazy like that. I like that sweet little hothouse mouth you have. I like to kiss you with tongue, with gusto, with socks still on. I love you like a vulture loves the careless deer at the roadside. I want to get all up in you. I love you like Isis loved Osiris, but her devotion came up a few inches short. I'll train my breath and learn to read sonar until I retrieve every lost blood vessel of you. I swear this love is ungodly, not an ounce of suffering in it. Like salmon with its upstream itch, I'll dodge grizzlies for you. Like hawks to skyscraper rooftops, I'll keep coming back, maddened, a little hopeless, embarrassingly in love. And that's why I'm on the couch, kissing pictures on my phone instead of calling you in from the kitchen, where you are undoubtedly making dinner too spicy. But when you hold the spoon to my lips and ask if it's ready, I'll say it is. Always, but never. There is never enough.
Such a great poem. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
This poem is such a triumph. I just feel like writing love poems is really hard. I think it's harder than people think it would be. And I wonder, talk a little bit about that, because I really think this is a triumph and I want to learn from you.
Well, the epigraph that I was asked to cut when it was first published as a poem was this one by Oscar Wilde, who frankly was very sardonic about, you know, romance and all those things. But the quote is, without exaggeration, there can be no love. And I loved how that is true of, like, when you, you know, are into somebody, that everything, the sky is bluer and everything is so much more perfect. And but only through that exaggeration would it be okay to write a more triumphant love poem. Because if you sound sincere, then you just seem a little bit foolish. Just some of that, like, absurd exaggeration could let me celebrate love without hopefully airing it in that, oh, sentimental and sappy way. But also, I think it's the opposite of Neruda. Instead of, like, a single song of despair, I think it was many, many songs of despair and then a final love poem. And I think the great secret of this love poem is that it is an elegy of the love was over when I wrote this poem. And it was more, I had the emotional distance for it to be a memory or a celebration of something that was already gone. But I'm really glad it doesn't read that way. But it's the real secret of the poem, is that it was an elegy. It was a love that was over, but that I was able to write back into and remember what it used to be like in the beginning.
Tell me then about the title. Is the title ironic?
I mean, like, I know it's ridiculous, but I've also, I know the truth of that feeling, right? So there is that, a great way of thinking about all emotions is that they're always valid, even when they aren't true. And of course, all of these statements aren't totally true. I actually probably wouldn't bother to read sonar to retrieve my beloved cut up. I think that's something only a goddess like Isis could do. But the truth of that feeling, I mean, that's still that I have felt that just ridiculously over the moon, completely drunk on hormones feeling for somebody before. And that felt like I was telling the truth, even if the promises we keep our beloveds totally fall short of the promises in this poem. And that's okay, because boundaries. But but it's nice to express that I love you so much that I believe this to be true in this moment. Mm-hmm. And I don't think it's hyperbolic to say it. I love you this much. And yet, the truth of love I always tell my students and really bum them out is that every love story ends either with you breaking up or with you watching that other person suffer and die. And there's a lot of taxes and laundry in between that, like, love, to live a love story doesn't feel like this poem. This poem is a moment. And in this case, it's actually an elegized moment. But that's okay. How you can't feel this exactly the moment something is over, but it really is so much luckier to have loved and known what that feeling is and to have been changed by somebody than to have, like, not known what that sort of feeling is. And I'm really glad that I've known the truth at the heart of this poem, what it's like to feel that way for someone.
I was thinking about it driving into the station today and thinking about how, again, just thinking about how difficult it is. It's difficult for me to write love poems. What happens oftentimes is I will start, I'll have a draft of a poem that is like clearly like a love poem to my husband, right? Who I've been mm-hmm. with, you know, over, I've been with my husband almost 20 years now, you know? And then, like, when I'm putting together a collection or something, the content of that poem, which is, you know, typically made up of imagistic noticings from my everyday life with my husband, will sometimes fit a better kind of poem. It would, you know, so I have the, I had a poem in my forthcoming collection that was like, it was a love poem. And then it sort of became just like a poem about domesticity and all the things in our life, which my husband is a big part of, but it's almost like, I don't know. There's something about, I think, love poems over the course of over the course of a relationship or over the course of a life. Like, it seems to me, in some way, it was making me think of, like, what people say about, like, casual sex and kissing, you know? Like, the kissing is so much more intimate than like, some casual sex act, right? That's, like, what the kids are saying. And Julia Roberts, I was just thinking that, too, yeah. And the, just in some ways, there's something so like intimate, obviously, about just like even the instinct or the feeling of like I'd like to write a love poem. I don't know. There's just it's I think love poems, sometimes people think, oh, well, that's just like a given. That's what poets do. They write love poems. But I think that they're very difficult to write, and they're very difficult to kind of see through to the end, you know, like maintain their integrity as love poems.
Yeah, and I think so about what, which is more intimate, the kiss or casual sex. I think all of this really depends on the vulnerability of the people and how much they are open to another person in the engagement of any of those physical acts, right? Because I think, right, you can shut down anything, or even a partner you've been with a long time, you could have sex then with that person that isn't intimate, even if you have shared all of these other things. And I think one of the reasons love poems in general are so hard is because they require a kind of vulnerability from me that I'm not very good at. So I feel like lots of people in my first poems were very just like, I can't believe you would admit something so brave, when I would talk about something that somebody else would keep a secret or private. And for me, as somebody who was raised with very few boundaries, it didn't even occur to me that I was sharing too much or saying something other people would keep more in the realm of the private. And also, that seemed like a lot of those dark things are just often subject matter that I've been much more upfront about historically. And just saying, oh my God, I'm so into you, feels so much more vulnerable to me. I feel like, you know, everybody talks about what's the thing you cannot say and what's the riskiest poem. And for me, sweetness is, tenderness is, that's the thing that when people give me a compliment, I find a way to throw it away. Or, you know, when my beloved says something sweet to me, I'll turn it into a joke. Or even in the poem itself, right? It's, I love you so much, but also I'm not telling you any of this. I'm looking at pictures of you on my phone while you cook dinner. Like, I'm not even actually expressing this to the person. It's such an intense emotion that I have to feel it privately and not even in front of another person. And so I think it is about, like, what are you actually sharing with a person, or where are you dispersing that intimacy elsewhere? And I think one of the other reasons, like, the poem maybe as successful is that it balances those absurd things with domestic things, like kissing with your socks on. That's a certain stage of a relationship. And, you know, some of these other ideas too, like not actually telling the person, but kissing pictures of that person when they aren't in the room, because it's embarrassing or difficult to be that in love with somebody in front of that other person.
It's true. It's like there's a double... It's like a double act of vulnerability, because it's a poem about the vulnerability of expressing love, sort mm-hmm. of unironic love, and then it's also about, and then it's also a poem, which is like sort of enacting that vulnerability in its very being, right? The poem itself, the act of writing the poem about the act of feeling that feeling. But you see what I mean when I'm just, I mean, I think maybe sort of what I mean is like stylistically Nerudian, the sort of like image upon image upon, you know, sort of unique metaphor. I think there's so many wonderful lines in this poem.
Thank you.
Yeah. I love you like a vulture loves the careless deer at the roadside. It's so perfect and gross. It's so gross and perfect.
Well, and I think that's another, you know, I'm not like moth to a flame, right? Like I'm looking for the other expressions. And when I wrote, I want to get all up in you, I was so excited because I was like, I think I might have written something funny. Yeah. I was so excited about, because I crack jokes all the time in my real life, but I never get the chance to be funny in a poem. And I just think also it's really what that suggests too about, if you've ever watched a vulture go after things, that's pretty ferocious and not actually a loving act, but it is really fun to put into a poem. And that's not the bird, right? It's doves or whatever in a love poem, and just sort of seeking out a lot of the opposite of the expectation of a lot of a love poem for surprise and tension. And to subvert what people think they're getting into in a love poem.
Now, this is making me think of my favorite Valentine, which is a picture of a, like, you know, teeth-bearing, what are they called? Oh, possum. It's a possum baring its teeth. And it says, what is it? Let's eat trash and get hit by a car. It's just so great. Like, there's something so great about that, you know? Like, that's like that vulture. It upends the, you know, the, and now I'm thinking maybe that, like, is why I love that little meme-y Valentine, is that it's kind of like a poem, right? It, like, and poems are a lot like jokes, right? They set you up and then they upend your expectations. That's the way that poems work. That's the way that jokes work. And many, many times, not always, but so I'm thinking about that when you're, you know, thinking about like the occasions in this poem where you do, where I think a lot of places in this this poem, a lot of lines in, I think that the vulture and the careless deer is pretty funny as well. You know, it's shocking and funny, you know, like, let's eat trash and get hit by a car. It's like,
now I know what Valentine I'm seeking out on the internet for
yes,
next week.
Yes. I wonder if you could tell me a little bit about your coming to poetry to begin with. How did you start writing poems?
I was a sad teenager who would buy beautiful notebooks at Barnes & Noble and then rhyme my feelings in there. And then I studied poetry as an undergraduate, and it was a different economic time, and there was, you know, good support for public education in Florida where I went. And, you know, I studied what I loved because I thought that's all I needed to do. And then I graduated and got a job in the arts at a Shakespeare theater even. And I just slowly grew so dead inside that I remember walking home from the theater one night and it started to rain and I started to cry because I could feel the rain and it was the first thing I'd felt in the longest time. And then, like maybe only you can do in your 20s, I was like, oh, this is it. I'm quitting all of this life and I am moving to New York City to be a writer. And one of the actors at the theater was an English professor, actually, who would teach their classes in the first half of the week and then come act for the second half of the week at the Shakespeare Theater. And he would leave me books of poetry in my work mailbox. And that's where I discovered poets like Rilke was just sitting at the front box office while, you know, Shakespeare was going on behind me and reading these amazing poems of all the people that he would just leave in my mailbox to loan me for, you know, a show or two. And it just made me, and that's the difference, right? For me is that, yes, I would write about my feelings in high school and I liked it. And then I studied it in college, but I wouldn't have even called myself a poet. I think people can call themselves at whatever stage a poet. But when I fell in love with poetry, like when it became just a part of the way I paid attention to the world and what I loved in a way that it became fundamental to me, that's when I was like, okay, this is it. This is what I'm giving my life to. And I quit my job and I left my house and my relationship and all those things and just moved to New York City to be a writer, whatever the heck that meant. But it meant being in love with my life and staying awake in it, if that makes sense. But for me, that was just like what made me a poet. Like I'd written poems before, but for me, being a poet was a way of being in the world that, you know, that absolute attention is prayer kind of way of being in the world. And it was also a place where I just found community because I like to joke that I'm a poet for the friends because there just is something about people who are poets. Maybe it's that they can do intimacy very quickly because that's the deal in the poem too. You got to get in, get intimate, get out, and just very quickly establish something real and say something important. And of course, poets are human beings, and sometimes they're disappointing or they're not, they don't turn out to be the ideas I have of them, which isn't fair to have that expectation anyway. But I just find that I really love so many of the poets that I meet, and they've helped me become who I was trying to be all those years ago. And I don't just mean from in terms of writing, and it's just where I found my people, where I feel less alone, even reading the dead or reading strangers, just people who connect over language and an experience of the world in that way have just really changed how I'm alive.
It's really incredible, isn't it, that we have this line as readers of poetry and as lovers of poetry across time. You know, I was just thinking about this. This was like, you know, again, like it's sort of like a very simple thought. Just pretty much all the thoughts I have are very simple. No, but just the idea that you can read dead poets and stay with them in that way, that it really is remarkable. It's a remarkable thing that we have. I love this. I wrote it down because it was so funny. You said, I got a job in the arts at a Shakespeare theater even. Like, the pinnacle of the arts job. It really is. And I love that. I wonder if you could just even speak a little bit more, because I feel like this is something that would be maybe useful to hear, maybe for, like, younger poets or younger artists who are trying to figure out how to find their way in the world. Like, it sounds to me like maybe what you're saying is that you wanted to pursue a life in the arts and you headed in one direction. And even, you know, even a life in the arts can feel like numbing to you if you haven't really followed the greatest passion, right? I mean, is that what you're saying? Like, tell me a little bit more about that moment in the rain.
I mean, I'm sure there's also stuff about my brain chemistry too, right? That certainly led to that moment. But I also think, I think I was following a script that this is, you know, you get a college degree and you get a job. And I was lucky enough to get one in a field that I really loved. And, you know, I'd been with the same person since high school and I had a little house and a whole life. And I was dead inside. I was doing everything I thought I was supposed to do. But I think those were so many learned desires that those were the things I was told to want. And by being a poet and like deciding to commit to that in a very different way, I think that I thought I was going to really truly find who I was. And there's part of that trail that did lead there, but also I think that poetry comes with its own ladder and there's all sorts of learned desires in that as well, right? For me, it was stepping out of the mold that I had been sort of offered in terms of models from my family or that culture suggested was, you know, a good, safe, you know, and even noble path or a stable path versus all the uncertainty I faced living my life a different way. But I think it's also really, really hard to know what you genuinely want. So even though I felt like so rebellious being a poet, then I realized I feel like lots of poets all want the same things. They want certain publications or certain residencies or certain things because that's a marker for success or because that's what their friend got or I don't know, right? But I think I learned a lot of desires from other writers as well. And so then figuring out what is it that I want to do? What is it that's really going to make me happy? What is it that I have to give that I haven't given yet? What are those things in me? And my trick is I write a pretend bio. So I'll imagine myself in 5 years. And it's like, where do I want to say I have been? What do I want to say I have written? What do I want to, you know, what other thing do I want to say about my life? And then I'm like, okay, I guess the next thing to do is go to Nepal, or whatever it is that, like, if I stop trying to make, you know, my life look like somebody else's or my CV look like somebody else's, I try and like listen better to what my own innate desires are or what I think is forbidden to me or, well, that's not what poets do or, I haven't seen anyone do that before. Just figure out what it is that's important to me and just do that, regardless of whether or not I know exactly how to, exactly just yet, but figuring it out as I go and trying to do something that is genuinely fulfilling to me rather than, you know, filling out lines that I've seen others fill out in their CVs or their professional bios. But what deep down do I need to say? Need to make, need to do, need to give, and try and answer those questions to find some sort of accomplishment or experience or piece of writing that would actually feel like I'd accomplished something or that it made me feel good. Because often I found that accomplishment just made me feel really bad. And then that's very discouraging as well. Like, well, what do I do? I want to keep writing, but a lot of these external things actually kind of make me feel worse about myself rather than better. And it seems like everybody else feels better. So what's wrong with me and how do I figure out how to live my life and write what I want to write and stay satisfied in what I do?
Do you think that those... I love pretend bio. Pretend bio, yeah. Also would be the greatest title for a memoir.
Maybe that's next.
Do you feel, or can you tell me and give me an example of a way that, like, doing that and thinking in that way about the future has changed your writing, like the what you're actually writing and what you're doing in your poetry?
I think sometimes it gives me permission to do things I think I'm not allowed to do. So I mean, I ended up doing a poetry comic with an illustrator because I was like, I just really love comics. I really want to do this. And so then I was like, okay, so you know this person, why don't you message them and see if you can work together? Or I really wanted to write like one of my bio lines is like, she has a novel in her desk drawer. And so I was like, okay, I'm gonna do it. People have written bad novels. If people can write bad novels, then I can write a bad novel. It doesn't matter if it's good. I just don't even want to publish it. I just want to have a novel in my drawer. And I just want to say that, you know, when working on my novel, I want to say that at a cocktail party. But just it's a way to sort of figure out maybe what a hidden desire is of my own and give myself that kind of permission. So I think it lets me sort of tune in to the quieter part of myself, perhaps, because I'm a very, as you can tell, a talkative person who really loves a to-do list and stays busy and loves an adventure. So I think getting quiet and getting still is very hard for me, but I learn really important things when I do.
Tell me about the novel in your drawer.
So my last book, Saudade, was about my mom's from Brazil, and I didn't get a lot of very good stories from her. So I sort of ended up making this fake family tree story in my last collection of poems. But when I was done writing that book, I was not done with Brazil, and so I just wanted to keep writing. And so the family tree goes backwards. It goes chronologically backwards in the book of poems. And so I ended up writing about the major rubber boom in the Amazon, and a man who keeps trying to replace his dead child with flowers. That's the best summary I have right now because I haven't worked up an elevator pitch. I've just written a lot about orchids and the Amazon and, why rubber seeds could give you the death penalty in the middle of a rainforest.
That sounds like a good novel.
Right?
I walked away from an academic job, sort of in the same vein as what you're saying. Like I was just sort of looking at my life and the pieces of my life and the things that I wanted to do, and I just couldn't see it all happening. Kind of walked away from from a teaching position, and it was really hard. I mean, it's hard on many levels. One of them is the like walking into the unknown, but I also really found it very difficult to walk away from what I thought. Like there was so much, there were like identity markers in that life for me that I felt like I never would even question, and then I was like ready to walk away from them, and it was really like disconcerting and like kind of feeling like, God, who am I if I'm not, you know? I always thought of myself as this person who is a teacher, you know? I was a teacher before I came to graduate school, so yeah, it's just that sort of progression through your life and sort of going like, God, wow, this is who I am. I didn't know that I was this person. And you just have to sort of follow those paths and see where they lead. One of the things that was really difficult for me to come to terms with that my husband pointed out, and I was really angry when he first did, and I was like, you don't know me, and that's a really mean thing to say, was that he said very lovingly and in service to helping me figure out what I wanted to do. He said, you don't like having a boss. And I had literally never considered myself in that capacity at all. Like I'm like a, you know, I keep my head down, I work hard, I never thought like, but it is, there has never been a truer thing. And now that I've been away from that kind of situation for a while, I mean, I have certain, like, you know, I definitely have people who I serve. But it is honestly like one of the core truths of my personality. And I really do have to say, like, I never would have thought of myself as a person who, like, well, maybe I'll just sort of try to do this on my own, you know? Like, I have a certain amount of anxiety and a certain amount of like a need for order and predictability that is absolutely not conducive to not having a boss and a structure and a hierarchy. So it's like sometimes you just find yourself too in these places where you're just like, I know this is who I am, but I also don't know. I need to figure out how to function in this place, you know?
Yeah, I remember I was once told, okay, I'll say it, my ex-husband said that I always had a gift for starting over, and I always had an exit strategy. And he meant it in a mean way. He did not say this out of love or as a compliment. But I think I just watched my family start over with so many boom and bust cycles with finances in my young life. And my parents got a divorce. We moved 5 times. I've moved 5 times since I was a kid, and I've just always been pretty good at starting over, which is also why the stability of something like a job that you could stay in forever is both welcome and terrifying. But this is the handy part of the fake bio too. It's like, I have other jobs that I would want to do. And I'm like, okay, if I get tired of this, I can always go X. Because I need to know that I can leave. I always need to know that I am not stuck. Maybe it is all of that uncertainty before, and maybe even a desire. I think phoenixes are such a stupid fucking metaphor, but I do think that, like, knowing that you can fall apart and pick yourself up again is just really important, like, self-knowledge, or like one of the most important things you can know about yourself is like how to just keep going.
I think this is like one of the like things about being an artist too that I find very like that idea that like I think there's something magical and necessary about that in terms of making art as well, because I think once you go, the gods have fated me to be a poet, and now I mean I have to produce poems. And they have to be high quality poems, and they have to speak to something very large. You know, we start putting these expectations on our work that, to me, I mean, I'm sure it works for many people, but to me, that is very stifling. You know, the idea that I have to be a writer, you know. I mean, I do. I know in my heart of hearts, like, I do. I have to be a writer. I know that. I know I've been on this planet enough years. I have weathered enough kind of like depressions brought on by not writing. Like, it's something mm-hmm. that is key to my well-being at this point in my life. But at the same time, just knowing, like, no, it's that idea of the sort of like worst case scenario. Like, what's the worst case scenario? That I never write another poem? Like, is that really, can I find a way to be happy in my life beyond that? Absolutely. You know, and just like knowing that and going like, okay, and I think that like one of the things that that's one of the ways that we teach poetry and we teach writing now, you know, like the idea that like, you're going to go to a writing camp and then you get published at the end in an anthology that people like your parents will buy and or whatever. This idea that like publication or the outcome of something is why we do it, where really... Like that, that to me only brings upon that feeling of pressure that I just can't abide by that to me. And I think it's also, you know, I feel like you about noticing as a kind of a form of prayer is something you said earlier.
I think that's Simone Weil, and maybe somebody else said it, but yeah, some version of that, like, absolute attention is prayer.
Oh, idea. Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Simone.
Yeah, I know. Which is interesting, too, because when I was looking for the poem to read at the end, I realized all of the love, almost all, I found another love poem to read. But like so many of the love poems were like love poems about God. In the beginnings of, I have a notebook where I handwrite out beloved poems. And, you know, at first it's all George Herbert and John Donne and, you know, these sorts of people. And it's just like love poems about the ineffable and the unknown. But I'm finding I'm more back in love with that. And what I love about a love poem to God these days, it's just a love poem to something you can't Google. But like, I am so interested in how increasingly difficult I feel negative capability is becoming, because there's always a way to assure yourself you know what you know or look something up. And I'm just such a slut for facts. I love knowing and I love learning. And yet I think what poetry does that's so important is just lets you exist in a space of indeterminacy and unknowingness. And that's just like one of the best gifts I think we can give ourselves. I do understand the appeal of all of the poems in the world that just reflect back to us who we are and like affirm the simple truths that we feel we know. But those complicated ones that you don't understand on first or even 10th reading, I love that so much more now. And I've been going back to those first poems that are in that book and just like, yes, to love what resists you. It's just a whole other different way of loving.
So what poem did you choose?
So the poem I ended up choosing is one that I fell in love with early on in grad school. And it's Ballad on the Streets of Buenos Aires by Yehuda Amichai. Should I talk about what I love about it or just read it?
I would love you just to read it. And then we can talk about it. And would you mind saying Yehuda's name up front before you read it?
Should I say it before I say the title or after, like I did with my name?
Would you say it before you say the title?
Okay. This is Yehuda Amichai's Ballad on the Streets of Buenos Aires. And a man waits in the street and meets a woman, precise and beautiful as the clock on the wall of her room, and sad and white as the wall that holds it. And she doesn't show him her teeth, and she doesn't show him her belly, but she shows him her time, precise and beautiful. And she lives on the ground floor next to the pipes, and the water that rises begins there in her wall, and he has decided on tenderness. And she knows the reasons for weeping, and she knows the reasons for holding back, and he begins to be like her, like her. And his hair will grow long and soft like her hair, and the hard words of his language dissolve in her mouth, and his eyes will be filled with tears like her eyes. And the traffic lights are reflected in her face, and she stands there amid the permitted and the forbidden, and he has decided on tenderness. And they walk in the streets that will soon appear in his dreams, and the rain weeps into them silently as into a pillow. And impatient time has made them both into prophets. And he will lose her at the red light, and he will lose her at the green and the yellow, and the light is always there to serve every loss. And he won't be there when the soap and lotion run out, and he won't be there when the clock is set again, and he won't be there when her dress unravels to threads in the wind. And she will lock his wild letters away in a quiet drawer and lie down to sleep beside the water in the wall. And she will know the reasons for weeping and for holding back. And he has decided on tenderness.
I love that poem. Can you tell me a little bit about why you chose that poem?
I think in part for my long relationship with it, of just it's one I have, you know, hand copied and carried around for 15 years now, I suppose. I love the anaphora of "and," as well as the refrain of "and he has decided on tenderness," and how that refrain changes every time. And I just think a love poem that goes into the future tense is cool. And I really love the refrain and the future tense and how often those elements repeat, but with change. And I just think that's incredibly beautiful. And when I teach it, people really want to start solving it. And they want to see a political metaphor, and they want to see, you know, well, I think this was just a vision he had at a stoplight, and I just want, and I really find the "what does this poem mean" to be the stupidest question about a poem ever. I'm so not interested in what it means most of the time. I'm interested in the experience. Like, I don't stand in front of visual art and like, well, what does this painting mean? I just like to experience its color and line and scale, and I just am way more interested in being inside of it rather than let me solve what this image represents in this way. And so even though a lot of those words are not beyond me or inexplicable, I really love that it still feels mysterious to me, It still feels a little beyond me. And I think that he's quite good at something I stink at. So, Basho said, avoid adjectives of scale and you will love the world more and desire it less. But I'm such a person of adjective and I pile them on. And I think there's like two in this whole poem. And I just think it's amazing that it could be so slender in that verb and noun way, that it's also nice to love something that is so different from you because it's not the way I write. And I think it's really important to adore those people, not because they reflect something about you or your own aesthetics, but that their skills are wildly different and you're not even sure you understand what they mean, but you know it's beautiful.
One of my favorite assignments to give writers is to write a poem where the title is an adjective and then you are not allowed to use any adjectives in the poem.
Oh, that's fun. I'm going to do that one.
It's really a great one because it's hard. It really is hard. And then you start splitting hairs about what constitutes an adjective, you know? Mm-hmm. And what's funny is that I always, I teach that lesson. You know, I still teach a lot. I don't teach it in the university, but I still teach a lot. And I do that lesson a lot. And I always start to quote that Basho thing. And then I totally forget what it is. So I'm so glad that you just read that quote. Can you read it one more time or can you say it? Obviously, you have memorized it.
It's avoid adjectives of scale. You will love the world more and desire it less.
It's like, it's like this little Zen koan, and it's so perfect. It's like a perfectly written little thing, and I need to just memorize it, or I need to like get it tattooed on my body because it is something that I'm like so always so anxious to say, and then I don't have it memorized, and then it's like something that you can't, you screw it up if you get one word out of place. It's just, it's almost, and in that way, it almost enacts what it is saying.
I know.
Yeah,
but I keep that around because it does remind me of one of what I know is my bad habit is I always have to do a round of revision where I'm just looking at my adjectives and how many I've used and can I pull back. But then next to it, I have C.D. writes, a poet's amplitude takes precedence over her strategies. And this is a thing I'm afraid of is my too muchness. And so I'm always torn between these two of like, well, hell yeah, my amplitude is more important than my strategy. And it's okay that I'm too much. And then also, but if I could pull back. And so just having with me those two tensions of, yeah, I'm extra and that's okay. But also, can I trim back an adjective? But like trying to deal with that tension within myself of always wanting more is more is more and piling things into a poem. And that sort of, yeah, avoiding those adjectives of scale. Yeah.
I love hearing poets talk about their experiences writing poetry because I think we all have an idea of what it's like, both from those of us who write poetry, from our own experiences, and then just like as onlookers thinking about how one's personality might correlate to their writing practice or something. And just hearing someone speak about it, because I don't, I've been interviewing poets for a long time now, and I've been reading and writing poems for a very long time now, and I've never come to hear someone say, this is the definitive way, you know, that in some ways that struggle, even that struggle that you're just talking about, that sort of struggle about like, I want to, the C.D. Wright thing, what is it? Say that one again?
A poet's amplitude takes precedence over her strategies.
Right. I want that to be my deal. And then, but I actually do need to go through, I always need to go through my poems and cut adjectives,
Yeah.
Like that's just, I think that's just a wonderful thing. It's like not only is every poet's process different, but every poet's process is constantly changing.
Well, and I think some of those approaches too, I didn't always used to be self-conscious about my too muchness until I got a couple of rough reviews about my too muchness. And then I was like, oh gosh, I'm too much, my bad. I didn't used to be self-conscious about it, but then that changed the way I approached the way I was writing, which on the one hand, who cares what those people said? But on the other, it's just like those things about life. If you have this picture of your life or a plan, or you learn your desires and you go after it in one direction and you're like, well, that blew up in my face, or, you know, my life, I had this whole picture of my life and it fell apart. And then you've just got to change course and figure out a new way of writing and a new way of being in the world. And I think poems are just a great place to fail. I used to live with theater actors in New York. And I don't show up anywhere and have people tell me to my face I'm not what they're looking for. I get a rejection slip, which is so much easier. But I think I love having poems as a place to fail, either, you know, fail in those aesthetic ways or put something down on the page that I'm like, oh, that is embarrassing that that's true about me. Or I'm ashamed that deep down I had this thought, or just to like really have you know, a few lines and some ink to really work out how you're in the world and who you think you are, and with some aesthetic with some adjectives, sometimes of scale, and try and figure that out on a page. I just think is a gift to have that.
Mm-hmm. You can find Tracy Brimhall's love poem Without a Drop of Hyperbole in her collection Come the Slumberless to the Land of Nod, forthcoming in March from Copper Canyon Press. This is Just to Say is produced at KUT Radio in Austin, Texas. I'm Carrie Fountain. Thanks for listening.